This is Alan Karpik on Golden Black Radio Express with our special guest, Bill Keller. And I want to thank our sponsors, Purdue Federal Credit Union, Follett's Purdue Bookstores, 6th Street Dive, East End Grill, and, of course, Charters Team Remax Ability Plus, and all the folks that have been sponsors for us for all these years and in these challenging times. We're greatly appreciative for. So, Bill, talking to you from Florida, this is unprecedented times in the history of the world, really, and we're living through them. And first, I wanted to ask you just a little bit about how are you coping and getting along, and your lovely wife Joyce and family. But bring us up to speed with that.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm down here in Florida, and I feel like me. This is probably the safest place for me to be because if I were to try to get back to Indiana, my biggest fear was trying to get back to Indiana would be that it's an 18-hour drive because I'm down the St. Pete area. And so I would probably have to break it up into 2 days, and staying in a motel or hotel on the way back was kind of frightening, to be honest with you, to try to attempt to do that. But Joyce and I are doing fine. You know, we pretty much isolated ourselves, except going to the grocery store or maybe going to the bank or, you know, a few other spots. Some of the restaurants down here have carry out, you know, so we might be doing a carry out once in a while. But for the most part, we stick pretty close to home. But as far as health wise right now, everything's going pretty good.
Good. No, that's good to hear. And I know you have two children in the Midwest as well that are safe and like the rest of us, at least quarantined and trying to kind of wait this whole thing out.
Yeah, the older daughter is over in Ohio, and I do believe that Ohio has a lockdown now on the state. And last time I talked to Jean, she was staying pretty close to home. Jill pretty much doing the same thing there in Indiana. Staying pretty close to home, trying to entertain the kids, doing things in the house, you know, trying to create opportunities for the kids to do things around the house so that the boredom doesn't set in. But right now, everybody's doing well, and we want to stay that way. And, you know, I hope everybody else is feeling the same way. Stick close to home, stay well. That's the main thing. I don't think, as we talked before, I don't think I've ever gone through anything like this in my lifetime, and I'm 72 years old, and this is probably the most scary event that we probably have ever gone through. And I saw today on TV in the United States there's been like 483, I think that's what it was, deaths from this virus. So it's a scary time for everybody.
Yeah, and like you said, it's unprecedented. And you've obviously, as an athlete and as a coach, and been around sports your whole life. What do you draw on to deal with this? I mean, you've had to deal with tough situations on the courts, and obviously you've raised children, et cetera. But what gives you your inner strength? How do you look at this from a day to day basis?
Well, you know, I think you have to look at the situation. You have to day to day listen to the facts that are being delivered over the TV. And I think everybody, I think through athletics, Alan, I think people learn discipline. And I do believe that this is a situation where people have to reach way down inside and create that discipline. Maybe it's not a discipline from an athletic standpoint, but it's a discipline to do the things that you're supposed to do. Do things right. You know, it takes, and I've done this myself. I don't know if you have, but, you know, I may be driving someplace like from the post office, or maybe the grocery store, and you may think, oh gosh, I want to go out and eat tonight. Well, you know what? You can't do that because that's normal. That's kind of the normal activity that people will do a lot of times. But you have to have the discipline to say, no, I can't do that. I've got to stay home. So I think discipline and really listening to facts is going to keep you safe.
And part of the idea of these podcasts during this time is let's focus on some things that can take our minds away from this. And you have had, as I said last year, and you were gracious enough to do a show with us leading into the Purdue game with Tennessee a year ago about this week. You are the only person that has the great connection of being a part of both the Purdue's Final Four teams. 1969, you were a point guard and a high level player for the team that went to the Final Four and played in the national championship game 50 years ago yesterday, that being Sunday, March 22nd. And, of course, as an assistant coach, you helped Lee Rose and staff and the Boilermakers with Joe Barry Carroll and company go to the Final Four in 1980. So you have many other claims, obviously a great professional career and coaching career with the Indiana Pacers, et cetera. But you think about that, that's pretty unique company to have had both those experiences at Purdue.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I think about the years that I played at Purdue and as a student, those are some of the best times, I believe, of my life. You know, I just enjoyed the people. I was in a fraternity, you know, going to class, associating with classmates and teammates. It was a fun time. It was really a memorable time for me. We were successful as a basketball team. You know, so when I think about those years, it's nothing but positive thoughts for me. And, you know, obviously you're disappointed when the season is cut short, you know, because I always like to watch Purdue play. But those are some of the best times of my life when I was a student at Purdue.
No question, and you have remain an all-time fan favorite. I wanted to ask you about one experience, which I think would have been, the 50-year anniversary of Mackey Arena, where you stood at half court and kind of represented the 1968-69 team as a senior captain, and, of course, on that team with the late Herman Gilliam as well. But what that experience was like to stand in front of that Mackey Arena crowd and talk about that experience in 1969.
Well, first of all, it was really enjoyable to go back, and it was also enjoyable to spend some time with my former teammates when we all experienced the same thing at the same time. So having the opportunity to go back and have a lunch with all those guys and reminisce a little bit and have fun together, and you know what's really kind of unique in that situation is when you get together as a team, everybody kind of falls into the same role as they were back
yeah.
years ago. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
You know, it's just like, it's just something that happens. You don't try to do it. It just happens. So having that opportunity to spend time with those guys was really fun. The other thing is standing in front of Mackey Arena fans, you know, my message was things basically are different, but things never change. So my point was we were there 50 years ago, and there was still a basketball team, there was still a coaching staff, there were still fans, there was still a cheer block, there were still all the things that were around it. Obviously stayed the same. Everything changes, but yet it's still the same. And so standing in front of that crowd, it kind of brought back those goosebumps, if you will, talking to the crowd, because you're kind of going back and again, you're reminiscing about an experience that was really fond memories. And that's what that experience was for me and still is today. Creates nothing but fond memories for me.
And again, we're going to focus more on the 1980 because we've linked the podcast from last year where you talk 69. But I do want to ask you one question. You know, you look back. Sunday the 22nd was the 51st anniversary of that national championship game, and you had two great players. You had several great players you played with. I mean, with George Faber and Chuck Mavis, though Chuck obviously didn't get to play in the championship game, but Tyrone Bedford, Jerry Johnson, but two extraordinary players in Rick Mount and Herman Gilliam that were teammates of yours. I'll first ask you about Herman, and Herman obviously passed way too early in 2005, but you came in with him at Purdue, and tell me about that relationship with him.
Well, you know, Herman and I really kind of struck a relationship from the very start. I don't know. I always tried, not only with Herman, but I tried with other players just to be friends, you know, to bond with players. And it was easy with Herman because he was really a good person. He was a fun guy to be around. He was a great player. We had the same things in common in that the common denominator was, you know, to be a basketball player and then to have success. And I believe that Herman, off of that team, probably sacrificed his abilities to score and to do some things for the team. And I think any successful team, you're going to have players that have certain skills that you're going to capitalize on. And Rick obviously was our scorer. I mean, Rick was outstanding, a great shooter. And Herman was a scorer also. And I think Herman could have scored more points, but I think, you know, he played the role that George King wanted him to play, and that was to defend, you know, to rebound, to get out on the break, block shots. I mean, Herman could do it all. And so when I think about Herman Gilliam, it brings nothing but great memories for me. And like you said, he passed away way too soon, way too early in his life. And when he died, it was like a dagger in me when we lost Herman Gilliam, because we were such good friends and close teammates, and I cried. I really
yeah.
cried, because he was such a good person and a good friend.
Hard to believe it's been 15 years, and Herman was a phenomenal talent. From that standpoint, he could do just about anything on the basketball court. At 6'3", he was unique from that standpoint. Rick Mount, obviously, you're both Indiana high school legends. Purdue had, I love the picture that you see, they way back in the day, of Denny Brady and Bill Keller and Rick Mount, all Indiana Mr. Basketballs, all involved with the same program at the same time. You all didn't play together because Denny was gone by the time I think your eligibility started. But tell me about Rick and what made him unique in terms of obviously one of the greatest shooters that ever lived. But tell me about your memories and thoughts on Rick.
Well, you know, when I think about Rick and his abilities at that time, as you've mentioned, Rick was a great shooter. But there are a couple things also that I really believe that made Rick a great shooter is, number one, his size. Because Rick was about 6'4", maybe 6'4½". He shot the ball high above his head. So a smaller player was going to have difficulty really getting up and creating some disturbance in his shot. So that size, I think, really helped. And it was tougher for a bigger guy to try to guard Rick, because I believe that Rick was one of the best at using a screen. Rick would come off those screens shoulder to shoulder, you know, and guys couldn't get through that screen because you got guys like George Faber setting screens, and Rick could take the ball down to that right baseline corner and pull up and shoot it, or he could shoot it any direction, going either direction, going right, going left, didn't matter, because I think he was one of the best that I can think of. He and probably Steve Alford and probably Reggie Miller. Those three guys, I think, were exceptional at using the screen. So if Rick hadn't been so good at using the screen, had he not been 6'4", maybe it would have been more difficult for him to do the things that he did. So Rick, not only being a great shooter, he had those other skills that really complemented his ability to shoot the basketball.
And nobody, few if anybody, could do it like that. But you had guys that could shoot it. You could shoot it, obviously, one of the great three-point shooters in the ABA, and when that all came about. And I guess I'll ask you a little bit of a philosophical question, because you played in a day, your playing days, obviously no three-point line. You made a living to some extent. I mean, you obviously had other skills as a player, but the ABA and the three-point helped you stay in that league for a while as well. But just give as a, from a coaching and basketball perspective, it's amazing how much the game has changed because of the 3-point line.
Well, everybody wants to be a 3-point shooter. You know, the thing that's, you know, and I ran basketball camps, Alan, as you know, for 37 years. And every kid out there that came, whether he be 7 years old or whether he be, you know, 14 years old, they're wanting to shoot the 3-point shot. And I think as far as teaching shooting and getting kids to understand the technique of how to shoot it, at an early age, if you're constantly working on throwing the basketball because the 3-point line is there and you want to shoot it, and it's exciting if you make one every once in a while, but I think it's a tough thing for kids to stay away from if they're really learning first how to shoot the basketball. But I love the 3-point play when I was playing because of the fact that, that Bobby Leonard, who was our coach with the Indiana Pacers at the time, he always encouraged me to shoot the three.
Mm-hmm.
There were many a time I'd be coming down the right side of the court in front of our bench, and I'll hear Slick tell me, "Billy, shoot the three, shoot the three." And he wanted me to shoot the three, especially on the break. So I think playing for a coach that really encouraged you to shoot the three, I believe that made it a whole lot easier for me. Just pull up and shoot it. Pull up and shoot it. But we had some other guys, too, on the Pacer teams that could shoot it. Roger Brown, Freddie Lewis. I mean, all these guys you know, could really shoot the three. Don Boozy was also a good 3-point shooter. So when a guy's yelling at you, shoot the three, what are you going to do? You're not going to pass it. You're probably going to go ahead and shoot it. So it gives you a lot of confidence.
Yeah, and of course you had a couple of years with Rick Mount as well, right, as a teammate
right.
Before he went to the Kentucky Colonels and other places as well in the ABA. But fun basketball to watch growing up in the state of Indiana, and I know Mark Monteith wrote a good, really good book on how the Pacers were formed, and working on another one to tell a little bit of the history. But it was a great way to watch pro basketball if you were a kid like I was in West Lafayette. We got to watch a lot of your games, and it was fun basketball to watch because of that colored red, white, and blue ball, but also that 3-pointer. It made it for fun.
Well, the style of play, too, I think, Alan, was something that players really liked because it was a fast-paced game. It was up and down. We had a 24. Let's see. We had it now.
You had a 30, right? Yeah.
We had a 30-second shot clock. And like I say, Slick wanted to play it up-tempo. But on the other hand, if we didn't have the opportunity to take the ball down quickly and get something off the break, then he wanted us to focus on the offense, of running some offense. And with 30 seconds, there was really enough time to run an offense and get good out. So the style of play so much different than the NBA, because the NBA was more slow down, more methodical. And I do believe that players coming out of college like the idea of the red, white, and blue ball and the up-tempo game. And I think had the ABA not run out of money, I do believe that, you know, the ABA could have lasted a lot longer and maybe even be more thought of as the professional team that went on to exist. I'm not saying that the ABA would be the pro game today, but I'm saying it would have been more competitive and as competitive as it was against the NBA. But the style of play was so much different and a lot of fun.
Well, and remnants of it are still, obviously, it's forever stamp is on basketball because of the 3-point. But also, I enjoyed Bob Costas, I think, had a real, I don't know, was it Showtime or HBO on the ABA? I don't know if you had a chance to watch that, but really great stuff about all the great players in that league, and it kind of like the AFL to the NFL, the ABA held its own, and the four, I know when the four or five, was it four teams that came from the ABA into the NBA,
right,
assimilated quite well into the league as well. So Great story in the history of basketball. Let's turn our attention to 1980, and for, you know, obviously you were an assistant coach for Lee Rose, and you know, we're recording this on Monday, March 23rd, but yesterday being the 40th anniversary of Purdue playing in the Final Four and its most recent Final Four appearance. Tell us the story about how you got to, because you joined Lee Rose's staff for 1 year. Give us the timetable of how you got that job and got on that staff, and tell me how that came to pass.
Well, I got a phone call one day from George Faber, who was an assistant coach for Lee, I think.
Right, his first year.
Was he there 2 years or
no? Just year? The first year, I believe. Yeah.
Okay, first of two. That's right. It was Lee's first year. And I got a call from George, and he said, I'm getting ready to leave to go into private business with the window company. And he said, I've suggested to Lee that he hire you to come in and take my place. And I said, well, yeah, I would be interested. So anyway, we talked and kind of got everything arranged, and George left, and I came in to be Lee's assistant. And if it hadn't been probably for George Faber, I would not have had that opportunity.
And you would, because you were out of the ABA in 77, 76, 77. What did you do in the interim prior? What were you doing prior to the coming to Purdue?
Well, I was running camps.
Yep.
That was basically what I was doing. I was trying to think at the time. I was coaching. I had coached, I believe, a year at Brebeuf Preparatory School in the girls program. So I was doing that, running camps, and then I got a call from George.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's really the start of it, of how it all got developed.
Yeah, and you had the opportunity. And then you have obviously going on after, and we'll hit that in a minute, but going on to be the head coach of University of Indianapolis, or Indiana Central, I believe it was called at the time. But let's go back to that season and the 1980 team, and a unique outfit, a team that finished, I believe, third in the Big Ten in a very rough and tumble league, to say the least. And yet, when you had Indiana and Ohio State, I think finished first and second. Indiana won the Big Ten that year. But tell me about your memories of that and what it took for this team to get to that level.
Well, I think with that team, you had a lot of different personalities to start out with, and I don't know if that team really ever did bond. I think it was interesting the way Lee Rose approached that team, but there was a lot of skill. You know, you had the main player was Joe Barry Carroll, who was an outstanding center. You had Brian Walker, who was the leadership point guard that kind of kept everything together. And with that team, there was a lot of talent. Drake Morris, Keith Edmondson, Scooby Scares, Arnett Hallman. You know, so there was a lot of talent there. But they all had their own personality. They all had their own approach of what they thought they should be doing. And I think Brian Walker was one of the guys that was the glue to kind of keeping that team together, as well as Joe Barry, even though Joe Barry was a very quiet person. I'm not sure if he really ever wanted to do very many interviews, but he was a real talent, obviously, because he went on and played – I don't know how many years, 13 years maybe, or so in the NBA, and had a good career there. But a team that was assembled with a lot of talent that seemed to be going in a lot of different directions that had to be pulled back in for them really to be successful. And so how that team became so successful, I'm not really sure, except looking at the guy that was coaching them.
Yeah,
which I know we're going to talk about, but Lee was a guy that I think obviously brought them all in and was able to kind of bring them all in, reel them in, if you will, to get them to play to the level that they played to get to that Final Four.
Yeah, Joe Barry has talked about publicly about just the fact that Lee knew what he should focus on, and I guess when you have a 7-1 center that has a lot of potential in Joe, that Joe Barry Carroll, you can do that. But talk about what you learned working with him. Not the easiest guy to work with as an assistant coach, but how he prioritized things and what were his strengths in doing that.
Well, first of all, I think Lee was an excellent X and O guy. I think he was an excellent basketball mind. His philosophy and the players that were there, he was able to take those players and put them into their strength. And I think that's a mark of a good coach, when you can take a talented group that's kind of going in different directions and bringing them in like he did. I think he did a wonderful job. Lee was tough to work for. I think Lee... Lee was the kind of guy that coached with fear. I mean, those guys, those basketball players at Purdue at the time respected Lee, but I think to a certain degree they feared him. They played somewhat out of fear. And I think to a certain extent, the way he reeled those guys in was those players knew that if they did something wrong, he was going to let them know about it. And so I'm sure you've talked to players, too, that felt the same way, that the way Lee conducted business was, you better be here at a certain time, on time, ready to go, or there was going to be consequences. And I think that's the way Lee coached.
A Southern, well, born and raised in Kentucky, and I did an interview with Joe Barry Carroll about his new book, the memoirs, Lee Rose's memoirs, which we'll have on our website later, some talk about that. But he was not a yeller necessarily. He had a way of kind of piercing you, I would say, just by the way he talked, kind of that Kentucky Southern approach that could be piercing at times. Was that your memory as well?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Lee would never scream. He would never curse at you.
I don't think he ever swore hardly ever at all that I was when I was around him. I don't think he ever did.
Yeah.
He
was not a boisterous person. But you knew by his facial expressions, with his eyes, with his gritting of his teeth, you knew when he was upset. And when he was upset, you wanted to make sure you didn't do anything wrong. And that, again, was part of his coaching technique that reeled everybody going different directions in. And he was a master at that. There's no question. He was a master at the way he coached.
Was it a challenge, or how was the challenge for you? Because you came in, even though you're a Purdue legend and well and beloved by Purdue fans, had seen you play in both professional. He had Everett Bass there. He had Mark Wise. He had Jeff Meyer, who actually came in, I think, maybe that year, or had been there the year before. Of course, Jeff now still coaching in college basketball up at Michigan. I think he's at Michigan, right? Is that where Jeff is? But tell me about that experience of being able to infiltrate that and have a role for yourself. Or was that a challenge that you couldn't overcome in that year?
Well, it was definitely a challenge. And I'll tell you, going back, I think Jeff Meyer right now is at Butler.
That's right. I that's exactly right. Sure.
I think that's
that is correct. Yeah.
When George Faber called me and was trying to get this all in the works, I was excited about going back to Purdue. Because of the what I had talked about before was how excited experience that I had, as a student there, as a student athlete there, the experience was just wonderful. And so I thought, gosh, this would be really neat. I'm going to go back to Purdue, and it's going to be fun and games, fun and back in the glory days. Well, it wasn't quite like that. when I went back there, Lee was always nice to me.
Yeah.
But I never really felt like I was one of the guys. You know, there were two circles at Purdue at the time. There was the inner circle, which was Lee's assistant coaches, Lee and his coaching staff, which I was a part of. Then there was the outer circle that was the George King circle that I was also a part of. So I sometimes felt, and this may have been on me, maybe I just felt this, but sometimes I just didn't really feel like Lee trusted me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I was in that outer circle, maybe too much, but there again, it may have been just the way that I felt. But Lee was just not easy to work for, and I was sent out a lot of times for recruiting. And but like I say, Lee was nice to me. But those two circles, I was involved in both of them, and it really was kind of uncomfortable for me at times. And I just had to deal with it.
And Lee, and there've been some document. You know, there are always the great question is why did Lee Rose leave Purdue? And of course, he did after Purdue goes to the Final Four for an opportunity at South Florida, and he took off after 2 years at Purdue. Did you have the sense of that, you know, again, being, you know, no, obviously playing for George King, the athletic director at the time, and obviously Bob King, who Lee talked openly in recent times about being, you know, certainly respecting the job Bob did, but that tension between them, I mean, without all of us, it's impossible for any of us to know exactly why, but how do you view his departure from Purdue and the reasons behind it?
Well, I do believe that Lee was having some health issues. I don't think he was really in good health at that time. I think he had a struggle too with keeping his players together.
Mm-hmm.
I was never involved in any of the meetings with George or Lee when they had meetings. I was never involved with that, but there was a conflict there. I think everybody that was around the athletic program knew that at the time. So that was also a factor that Lee had to deal with. So I do believe that Lee was dealing with a lot of different things, with his illness, with the team, with the outer circle. All of that he was dealing with, and I think maybe he just really felt like it was time for a change, time to get out of town. So I really don't know why he left. I was on a recruiting trip, and I can't remember exactly where it was. It may have been at a junior college tournament in it was out in Kansas, I think,
mm-hmm.
And I got a call from Everett Bass, and Everett said, and this was right after the season, Everett called me and he said, "Hey, Bill," he said, "Lee wants you to come back." And I said, "Lee wants me to come back?" I said, "I just got out here. The tournament really hadn't even started yet." He said, "No," he said, "Lee wants you to come back." And I said, "Well, what's the deal?" And he said, "Well, I don't know for sure," which I don't know if he did or not, but he
yeah.
said, "Lee wants you to come back." So I said, "Okay, I'll get on the next plane that I can, and I'll get back." So I got back, and then that's when they had that ceremony there at Mackey, and Lee made a speech in front of the student body and what have you, and introduced the players, I think, I don't remember exactly what happened from there, but I do believe that when I was out in Kansas, I do believe he had made up his mind. Again, this is just my thinking. He had made up his mind that he was going to leave. And I was the only one that was not going to South Florida with him.
Yeah.
Because he took Mark, he took Everett, he took Jeff and himself, and left to go to South Florida. And so I was left there when Gene Katie came in. And so I was there during the summer when Gene came in. And Gene and I had developed a relationship, a good relationship. He used to come over to the house about dinner time.
Yeah.
And he liked those Bloody Marys.
Yeah.
So Joyce had fixed him a Bloody Mary, and we'd just sit around and talk and have some dinner, and then he'd head out. But I don't know exactly why Lee left, but it could have been because of all the things that I've stated.
And I want to go back to the actual that Final Four week in the games. But, yeah, I think that and you had an opportunity to stay with Gene, right? And tell us a little bit about your thought process and how that all played out, because obviously you didn't, and you went on to coach at the University of Indianapolis or Indiana Central. But tell us about that.
Well, looking back on it, I wish I would have stayed, to be honest with you, because I think Gene – would have been a wonderful head coach to work for, and we had a good relationship, and he wanted me to stay. He offered me to stay. He came to me and he said, I didn't realize that no one had mentioned to you about staying. And I said, well, no one had. And he said, well, I'd like for you to stay. And that was at the time that I had really already committed to the University of Indianapolis, which was Indiana Central at the time. And I, you know, I made that commitment. My wife Joyce was not real happy being in Lafayette. We were out in Klondike. She was away from family members in Indianapolis, and she really was wanting to get back. And she liked Lafayette. She liked Purdue, you know, but the family was the draw going back to Indianapolis. You know, so when I made that commitment, I just felt like I needed to follow through with it. Well, I was at the University of Indianapolis, and Gene called me after his first year, and he said, hey, he said, I'd really like for you to come back. And I said, you know, I said, Gene, I'm already here, and I was really not making this decision just for me. I was making it for the family, and I just really felt like at the time that was the right thing for me to do for my family, was to stay at Indiana Central. One thing about Indiana Central, when I went there, I was the head basketball coach in the men's program. I taught some classes, and I was also intramural director. Well, one afternoon, I was out, because being the intramural director, you have to get the facilities ready. Well, I was out lining the softball diamonds, you know, putting the lines down and doing all the stuff to get it all prepared. And here comes across the field a guy walking towards me. So I looked at him. I never gave it too much thought. I kept doing what I was doing. And this guy got a little bit closer, and he got a little closer, and I finally realized it was Lee Rose walking across the field. And he came up, shook my hand, and had a smile on his face, and no game face, no tension. It was just a friend that was coming to see me. And he laughed, and he said when I was at, I think he was at Transylvania, and he said, you know, I did the same thing you're doing now at Transylvania. And so we talked out there for just a few minutes, and then he left, and that was the last time that I had actually seen him. Now, when I was at the University of Indianapolis, I always tried to take our team someplace during the Christmas holiday. And so for a couple of years, we came down here to Florida. And while we were down here, we were going to play several teams. There was Rollins College and Tampa. We were going to play Tampa down here. And then also, I can't remember exactly who else it was, but there was another one down here we were going to play. And we needed a place to practice. So I called Lee, and I said, hey, would there be any chance that we could go over to South Florida and practice? And he said, yeah. So he set it up. We went over and had a shoot-around, just a little practice. And then he got us tickets to come to the games, to a game, while we were down here. So it's really strange how you're deep – in the situation, as I was as assistant coach, the challenges, dealing with all of that, the inner circle, the outer circle. And I want to tell you that I never, never was disloyal to Lee Rose. Never. Even though I was in that inner circle and also the outer circle, I was never disloyal to him. Because I never would have done that to him, and I had too much respect for him. And George would never have put me in an awkward situation to put me in a situation where it would create problems for me with Lee in the inner circle. So I respected a great deal for George, and I had a great deal of respect for Lee. And anyway, it was really funny. It's really funny how when you're deep into it, there's tension, there's the day-to-day things that go on with coaching and the coaching profession and dealing with assistant coaches and head coaches and players and administrators and that kind of thing. And then you see Lee in a setting like when I was at the University of Indianapolis, he walked across the field. It was a totally different game face.
Yeah.
In fact, it wasn't a game face. It was a friendship face. It was a, I've done this before, with a smile on your face. You know, with Jeannie and Joe when they were young, when we were up there, they were, I don't know, they must have been 7 or 8. I'm not sure. They were young at the time. And after games, Lee would get down on one knee and he would talk to Jeannie and Jill. And it was just like when you see it, and Joyce even mentioned it. She said, it's almost like it's out of character. Mm-hmm. But Lee did have a heart. And I saw that side of him when he dealt with Jeannie and Jill. And he was always nice to Joyce. So I am so glad that I had the opportunity the last time that I saw him that he didn't have a game face on. He had a face on of, like I said, friendship and kindness, and it was really good to see, and especially in the situation that I feel like he's in now.
Yeah, well said. And did you have any indication, because and as a manager on that team, and I was a sophomore, I don't, you know, in memory gets clouded over 40 years. Did you have any indication going into the tournament that he was looking someplace else? Did you think that was something that was possibly going to happen? What were your memories of that?
I was not privy to any of that information. I really wasn't. I mean, Everett sent me out to Kansas.
Yeah.
And I was not in any of those meetings to know whether he was leaving or not leaving. And
but even on a rumor standpoint, even like a couple of weeks before the end of the year, you didn't have any sense that this could happen from that standpoint, even just scuttlebutt type or feeling.
Well, I didn't have a feeling, but I did hear that there were some rumors going around that he might leave. And then obviously when I spoke with Everett when I was out in Kansas, I said, well, is he planning to leave? And he didn't answer my question.
Yeah.
And I asked him a couple times. I said, Everett, is he leaving? And he didn't answer my question. I said, you know what? If he leaves, I'm still going to have to be out here recruiting. And he said, no. He said, Lee wants you to come back.
Yeah.
So from that, I kind of assumed maybe he was going to leave. But I didn't 100% know that.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know if you talked to Drake Morris or not. Have you talked to Drake Morris?
No, I have not. I saw him about a year and a half ago, and I know Drake has some strong opinions about that. But go ahead.
Well, at that little pep rally, Lee was sitting about two seats away from me on my right, and Drake and Keith, I think it was Keith Edmondson, were sitting to my left, and there was really no love lost there in that situation. So I'm sitting there, two seats from Lee on my right, and Drake Morris was a seat away from me on my left, and he's leaning over to me saying, I hope he leaves. I hope he leaves because he had more years there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Drake, I said, not now.
Yeah.
Not now. Because he was saying it loud enough, I thought, that Lee could hear that.
Yeah.
And I didn't want Lee to hear that.
Yeah.
And I already knew how those guys felt.
Yeah.
And I said to Drake, not now. And that's all I said to him. Not now. And then he finally understood what I was saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, those guys were talented players. There's no question. And, you know, Lee was a good coach really for them, and his technique of holding that group together. And, you know, Lee's two leaders on that team were Joe Barry and Brian Walker. And those two guys were the guys that were, and I don't want to say it, they were dealt with kid gloves, but he kind of catered to those guys because they were also the glue that were on the floor with all these other guys.
Yeah.
And I think that was, again, smart on Lee's part to pick those two players out. There were two, the best player and the best guard, to get the ball into Joe Barry and utilize their talents and reel everybody else in. So Lee was really a master at coaching.
Yeah. One, and going back to, I don't know what your memories were of that, of the tournament, but I'll go back to the 50-year anniversary of the UCLA game. But really, when you go back and watch the first half, which you can on YouTube and we put on our site, it was not Purdue's best performance, especially the way that you had played in the first four games of the tournament. I mean, beating LaSalle and St. John's, and then, of course, beating Indiana down in Lexington and Duke in Lexington as well. But what were your memories, any anecdotes or of that game against the Bruins, the game in Market Square Arena, which UCLA won 67-62?
Well, a little story going back. You said we beat IU. I don't remember a whole lot about the game, but I do remember – after the IU game, we were playing in Lexington, Kentucky, and Lee had a lot of friends there.
Yeah, because he'd coached at Transylvania, which is in Lexington,
right,
and grew up there,
yeah, and
around there.
So he grew up there. He had lots and lots of friends there. Well, one of the responsibilities that I had was to carry the money and to provide the players with their I can't remember if it was a per diem.
Yeah, it was a per diem, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a per diem. So I carried the money. And I would give the players their money, and I would give it to them slowly so it would disperse over the time that we were there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after that game when we beat IU, Lee comes to me, and he said, "Do you have any money left?" Lee never carried any money.
Yeah.
So he said to me, he said, "Do you have any money left?" And I said, "No." I said, "I've dispersed it to all the players and coaches, so I don't have any money left." And he said, "Well, do you have a personal credit card that I could use?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I can give you my personal credit card." So I gave it to him, and then we went back. Well, taking all of his friends out, it ended up being quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lee wasn't a drinker, you know, he wasn't anything like that. But they went out, there were a lot of people that went out, and they had dinner someplace. I don't know if they had drinks for the other people that were there. But,
yeah.
You know, when I saw how much it was on my credit card, I thought, "Oh, my gosh, how am I going to get this back?" And this is the only time that I went to George King and I said, "I need your help."
Yeah.
And I told him what happened, and he said, "Don't worry about it." He said, I'll get that money back for you."
Yeah.
And yeah. And he did. And that was the only time that I had ever asked him for anything while I was working for Lee Rose.
Yeah. In the game against UCLA, any what's your memories? That's a great story. But anything from that game that you, looking back at it, that resonates 40 years later?
Well, I don't remember that much about the game, but I'll tell you what I do remember. I remember being very irritated because UCLA knocked us out in 69.
Yeah.
And now, in 1980, UCLA knocked us out in the first game of the finals. And that resonated with me and has still today. I still do not like UCLA.
Yeah.
And that's what I remember the most. That's what stands out the most. And had we played better, I do believe we could have won that game.
Yeah, just got behind the eight ball to start and had a couple chances down the stretch, but just wasn't to be. And Kiki Vanderway had a big game in that game, as you may recall. And Joe Berry, they did a good job on Joe Berry, holding him to 17 points. So Keith Edmondson, I think, had 23. But it was a tough loss from that standpoint. Well, Bill, I appreciate your time, and we went way extra long, but it's a podcast after all, and during these days, I know that our listeners will enjoy your stories, and we wish you health and like everyone else out there that's listening as well, health and safety during this time, and we appreciate that very much.
Well, thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to share, and it's always fun talking to you, whether it be on a podcast or just on a phone call.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun, don't we? If we ran everything we talked about off the air, it would make for a whole other story, but we can't do that. So, but this is great stuff, and you had some really in good stories there. I want to thank our sponsors, Purdue Federal Credit Union, Sixth Street Dive, First Source Bank, Follett's Purdue Bookstores, East End Grill, and the Charters team Remax Ability Plus for their sponsorship of Golden Black Radio. Stay safe, everybody. We'll have more, as many of these as we can have during this time frame, and there's a difficult time for all, but we appreciate you listening.